Thank you.
I am Steve Baird, and I am an alcoholic. And why I tell you my last name is because some of the stories I'm going to share with you, the only way I can describe them is by last name. The Marines have a lot to do with that, so you'll hear about that. Wow. Ryan, you could have went about 20 minutes more, man. But here we are, and I'm grateful to be standing up here. I'm grateful to have been asked to be here. I'm a little nervous. But I'm not as nervous as the first day that I came in here. You know, when I sat in here and I looked around at everybody and saw some people happy and some people miserable, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing here. So I'll tell probably quite a bit about how I got to where I was in life that led me up to detox and entering here. My sobriety date is February 10th of 2013, so I have just over a couple years. So I'm going to spend more time talking about what it was like, a little bit of time about what got me here, and then what it's like now. So I will try to get to 8 p.m. All right. So I was born here in Orchid.
There you go.
I was born in Orchid. I'm the oldest in my family. I have a sister. My mother gave birth to me on her 21st birthday, and my sister on her 23rd birthday. So all three of us have the same birthday, which is pretty neat. Both my dad and my mom, when they were younger, man, they were partiers, you know. And my dad still is, but they were partiers. I remember we had a party for just about everything and anything that came in. And my dad comes from a family of 10, so I have aunts, uncles, and cousins galore around here too. My mom from a family of 6, just a little bit different dynamics. You know, my dad's dad died when he was 12 years old, and so he didn't really understand what it's like to have a father, and I think that plays a lot into my story and how he raised me. But, you know, some of my earliest memories of alcohol were always coupled with fighting. There was an alcohol, there was a big party, and then there was a fight to end the party. And then the next time they saw each other, it was all love and hugs and let's drink again and another fight. And that's just kind of the way it progressed. And eventually my parents divorced. I was about 7 years old. I went to stay with my dad for the weekend, and I came back to the family home that my mom kept, and we had 3 bedrooms. And I came back and I remember walking in and seeing my mom's friend, like, moving into my bedroom. And I thought, what the hell? Oh, and truth be told, I'm a former Marine, so if you think sailors cuss, Marines do too. And I will try to keep it to a minimum. Sorry, Hazel, ahead of time. But, you know, I thought, what the hell is going on? You know, I feel angry about this. You know, why is this happening when I'm not home? And I felt abandoned, you know, by my mom. It was really like, how are you going to rent my room out and where am I going to go? And so she says, well, you can move in with your sister. I said, well, why don't you make her move into Nicole's room and I can keep my room and she can move in with me. I'm the oldest, right? My entitlement part of it. It didn't work out that way. And I got so pissed off that I went back to my dad's. And his way of helping me through tough times is to go buy me something. So he went and bought me one of those incredible Hulk punching bags with the sand at the bottom. And boom, it was on. I got to hit that thing, get all my frustrations out. And, you know, I think that was his best form of parenting for me, was to keep me engaged in something physical. Well, a year later, we move up, my dad and I move up to Northern California, up to Santa Rosa. And at that time, the abandonment and everything that I felt from my mom was replaced by sadness, missing my mom, missing my sister. That was a tough thing. And when we went up there, you know, my dad was full of promises about what we're going to do. You know, life's going to be great and this and that. Well, we went up there and moved up to a house that, I kid you not, was a remodeled chicken coop on a property. And I could see through the walls. I could see outside. It had a fire, little wood-burning stove in it. Had an apple orchard outside, and it was way at the top of this dark hill in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, I'm already starting fifth grade in a new school, but now I'm alone because my dad, his way of dealing with the divorce was to go to the bar. So I would roll up my socks during the day and I'd make a football, and I pretended I was Tim Brown, and I would throw that football in the air and I would run out there and dive in the orchard, and that's what I did to kind of pass my time. And, you know, my dad got a DUI, he wouldn't come home, various things, and I thought, wow, you know, I am ultimately alone here. Like, survival kicked into me at about fifth, sixth grade. And I remember, well, my aunt told me recently, I didn't really remember it until she brought it up. She said that she had shown up to the house to check on me, bring some groceries, and I was sitting there in the dark. And she's looking for me, Stevie, where are you? And I said, well, I'm right here. She says, what the hell are you doing sitting in the dark? I said, well, I'm trying to save money. I saw the PG&E bill came in, and we're going to get the power turned off. So there I was, sitting in the dark, trying to do my part, be some kind of responsible person at that age. And it just continued on. I remember we moved into several houses, get kicked out, and the final one that really had an impact on me was we were in these apartments, and I was getting ready to have my birthday, and finally I was going to get a chance to have friends in school. People were going to show up because we had a pool at our apartments. So my dad promised me he was going to go down and have the pool heated for the birthday party. Didn't happen. It didn't happen. I had all the kids come over, and it was cold as hell, and nobody wanted to get in. So popularity right back down. And, you know, if you were like me, popularity kind of meant something in school back then. And so I wasn't really fitting in. And I heard one night, I'm out there, I'm in bed, and I can hear some guy arguing with my dad. He's coming around to collect for a debt. You know, my dad owed him for some cocaine, and it was a big deal. And I was terrified. And eventually, my mom had remarried and moved to Montana, so I decided to go to Montana for a summer, my freshman year. And I get up there and, you know, make a few friends, and Montana's all right. And then I decided to stay and go to school there. Well, that's when things changed a lot. I don't know if anybody's been to Montana, but they are the least diverse culture in the world, I would say. There's really no Hispanics, no blacks, there's nothing. It's just all white, all cowboys. And they said, oh, you're from California, huh? So you're either a surfer or a gangbanger. And I said, well, shit, I'm both, you know? What the hell? I'm gonna be a smart ass, and that's what I was. And I started playing football and started to hang out with some of the right people. And then I ended up being pretty successful as a freshman and got bumped up to JV, which was a turning point for me, because the varsity and JV safety, free safety, that played those positions, they came after me. They didn't like me. Here's this California kid, man. We're not going to take his shit. I don't care how good he is. And then here came the bullying in high school. And I decided, wow, you know, now I'm getting bullied. It's different than just being alone and being not popular. So I end up acquiring a little 380. Well, actually, I stole it out of my friend's dad's gun safe. And I took this 380 to school. I was going to protect myself. And, you know, it didn't cross my mind one bit that I was doing anything wrong. You know, this is how I was taught to deal with stuff. It was going to be anger and violence. And I had yet to be in a true fight. I remember this kid, Tony, he kept coming and following me, pushing me into lockers and stuff. And this day I didn't happen to have the gun at school, thank God. But he followed me out to my car, and he was there. He wasn't going to let me get in my car and leave. So I had no choice, I felt like. And he pushed me a few times, and that was it. And I hit him one time, and I think I had years of anger and frustration built up inside of me. And when I hit that kid, he went down, and I thought, oh, thank God, it's going to end. No more violence, no more trouble from the high school guys. Maybe I solidified myself as being tough. Yeah, no. No, all the seniors, all the varsity then, all the football players wanted a piece of me then, because they thought, oh, you want to be tough? We're going to show you what it's like to be tough. So it kept going on. And then, why I tell that story is because then I met alcohol. And I met Southern Comfort for the first time. Man, terrible tasting crap, but did it make me feel so good. I think that first night I slept with this ugly chick. you know, and I still don't like to admit that, but I'm pretty sure that happened. And I was off and running, and I started, you know, started the beer drinking and stuff, and that Southern comfort, man. There was something about that Southern comfort that just made me warm and feel good. And I didn't, you know, I think it took away all that anger, all that nervousness, all that insecurity, and just replaced it with just peace. That's what alcohol did for me. It really mellowed me out. So I thought it was perfect. You know, how could I go wrong with something like that? So after some more miserable time in Montana, I decide in my infinite wisdom that I'm going to move back to Northern California with my dad. And me and my dad are going to be buddies again, and things are going to be different. And we come back. He got me a little house on the river, a little apartment. The river would flood, so it would smell like mold in there, like, because I don't think they replaced the carpets or nothing, but it was just a shitty old little spot. And my dad lived at the top of the hill with his girlfriend, so he was gone all the time. But I had freedom. At that time, I was 17 years old, and I thought, hell, this is kind of cool. Nobody there to bother me. I can do mushrooms, LSD, back in the time, the old crank, you name it. It was anything and everything. And, of course, Northern California is known for its pot, so I definitely partake in that. And fast forward into my senior year, the end of my junior year. I still like that fighting part, by the way. So I'm in this school, and I get in 3 fights in about a half a year. And as a result of that, I got kicked off the football team, got expelled, and it was time to go to a continuation school. Well, cool, continuation school only had 4 hours of school a day, so I'm cool with that, right? I don't have to go to school all day. It was an easy way out. So I'm sitting there in continuation school, spinning my wheels, and I started drinking 40s, you know, the old Mickey's 40s. They were popular for us back at the time. I found my little hookup at the liquor store, and I think I had a fake Arizona driver's license or ID card, and it was, I don't know how the hell anybody in their right mind thought that would have been a valid ID, but it was, and it worked. So I'm sitting there partying, I'm partying, and I'm faced with, I'm not going to graduate high school if I don't get all this homework made up. I had like a 0.17 GPA. It was not a pretty sight. I just chose to not do my schoolwork. I didn't have to turn in a report card. I had no guidance whatsoever to tell me, hey, this is the right way to live life. So it comes down to my last month, I think, of high school, and I decide that me and my 4 buddies are going to go join the Marines. We're going to go sign up and let's get the hell out of here. And they were all for it, too. So all 4 of us go on this thing called the Buddy Program, and we all enlist, and we're all getting ready. And meanwhile, I'm still recruiting other kids that are in my school using crank as the tool to get them to come over and do my homework for me so I can graduate, get that diploma, and ship on out. So I was pretty manipulative as far as that goes as well. And I graduated, believe it or not. I mean, that stuff must have worked, but I graduated. And at my graduation, there's my recruiter in his dress blues, and he says, you know, Steve, I'm going to take you right now. We can change your date. You can go right now. And I said, no way in hell. Like, I'm going in, I'm supposed to go in August. And he's like, yeah, no, but I don't know. It's good you stick around here. You know, I see what's going on here. You should probably just go now. And I pushed him off. I refused to go. And in come August, I had my big going away party. And there was about 100 people invited. And my dad, being the loving dad, he went out and bought 3 kegs and about $300 in hard alcohol. And have fun, kids. And we lived out in the middle of nowhere at that time. He had a new girlfriend. So needless to say, it breaks out into a big fight. And everybody's fighting. My dad's fighting. You know, I think my dad started the fight, probably. And all I remember is seeing one of my best friends fighting with my dad. I don't know if it's an argument or what, but I'm tanked. So over the 4-foot fence I come, hit the guy, hit my best friend. Bust my hand on the top of his head. Don't punch people up here. It's not good for you. So I bust my hand. One of the guys I was going into the delayed entry program with fought a cop that night, Bubba. And Bubba's disqualified from the Marines. Chad and Jay were the only 2 that were left to go on our original date. And Jay ends up with tubes in his ears, and Chad ends up going. Well, Chad comes home in 3 weeks while I still have a broken hand, and he's like, man, that is the hardest shit in the world. Marine boot camp is no joke. And I thought Chad, you know, I had him elevated. He was some tough guy. he was home singing the blues, and I'm sitting there going, oh, crap. Like, I still have to go do this, and now I have to go by myself. Well, December 11th rolls around, and I ship off that night to San Diego. And I stand in a room with 62 other guys, and I'm looking around, and I'm going, oh, my God. You know, here we are off the bus, and the drill instructors are screaming at you, and you have no time to think about anything. And the one thing I was used to, though, was the yelling and screaming. I could handle that stuff. That wasn't a big deal. The physical stuff, and they're throwing things at you and pushing you and slapping you and all that, I could handle all that. I loved it. So next thing you know, Mr. Insecurity is graduating as top of my class in basic training. I'm the honor man because I had a way of dealing with that pressure. And I thought, wow, that's an achievement. I can do something with my life, right? I can achieve things I didn't know were possible. So I go to my next school. I blow through that. I do great in that school. And I'm starting to realize that the Marines praise me for being loud and yelling and, you know, being aggressive and all that stuff. And I started to think, man, I really fit in here. This is my home. There's no better place for me in the world. So I'll tell a... Yeah, I'll tell a quick story about basic training. See, me and my infinite wisdom, I always keep going back to that because I think I'm so smart all the time. I think I'm a genius. So I chew tobacco, right? The drill instructors, we live in a big room like this, and say they got a little room here. Well, the way they empty their trash can is they take it and they throw it out the door and say, clean it up. So we go clean it up. Well, all of a sudden, these little cans of Copenhagen, they go rolling out of the trash can. So, and you're not allowed to chew tobacco in basic, you're not allowed to smoke, nothing for 3 months. Well, I would get these little cans, and I would scrape out whatever the hell was in there, and I'd stick it in an envelope, and I'd start saving it. And one night, I decided that I'm gonna go, and I'm going to have a chew, but the manipulative part of me made the other guys go with me and have a chew, the other squad leaders. So I made four guys. I threatened Firewatch and said, don't you dare tell on us or we'll kill you. We'll, you know, give you the old Code Red blanket party. But the four of us went in there, and we have these dips in the bathroom, and man, I think I get away with it. You know, I always think I get away with something. And the next day, the drill instructor calls me in, and he says, come here, guide. He says, man, you've done a hell of a good job for me. He says, do you chew? Sir, no, sir, this recruit is in basic training, sir. He says, oh, are you going to chew when you get out of here? I says, sir, yes, sir. He says, all right, we'll have one. I'm looking at him like, oh, shit. You know, okay, I'll have one. So I put in a little pinch. And he says, no, 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 no. You take a real man's dip, Baird. Upper lip, lower lip. And they called me bird shit because I have a mole right here. And they said that was my asshole on my chin. So that was some of the stuff. You know, they had all kinds of names for me. So I take this dip. I put it in upper lip and lower lip. Well, that chew belonged to a guy named Messick. And Messick, I swear to God, was bred with Paul Bunyan. This guy was... might as well have been 7'5". I don't know how tall he was, but he was big and he was menacing. And he comes in, he's pissed off, and he goes to that can of chew and he packs it up and he looks and it's empty. He doesn't think nothing of it, goes to the fridge, grabs another one, turns around and sees me, and there I am. And if you remember the movie Turner and Hooch, that dog that drooled, I'm standing there going, oh God, and here it's coming out of my mouth. And he turns around and he says, you swallow every bit of it. So I attempted to swallow it. I threw up in the drill instructor's bathroom or in their living quarters, and they didn't like that. And next thing you know, I'm doing push-ups, trying to drink water out of canteens and puking again, and clothes are coming off, and I'm mopping up this puke. And I'm storing this stuff in my footlocker till graduation for like another month. And he tells me, he says, your breath still stinks, Baird. And I said, sir, yes, sir. He says, go get some whiskey. That's what we call it, yellow Listerine whiskey. And I knew he was going to make me drink it, so I get the one with the least amount in it. My infinite wisdom, right? Come back in, drink it. Boom, I put it back. He says, your breath still stinks, Baird. Sir, no, sir. Am I going to think it stinks? Sir, yes, sir. Go get a full one. And I run in there, and I have to grab a full pint of yellow Listerine. Well, I didn't really know that mouthwash has that much alcohol in it. And I had to drink that whole pint of yellow Listerine, which I still cannot stand the taste of today. But I remember like getting drunk in basic training. And it felt good, but the fear and everything just kind of offset the enjoyment of it. But you know, it was just an example of like at the levels at which our training came at and the cost of any sanity and reason that I knew of. And so when I got assigned to Japan as my first duty station, I'm thinking, all right, I'm a full-fledged Marine now. I'm going to go over there and I'm going to be a badass. And I was. I thought. And I get out there and I'll tell you what, Japan has got some interesting alcohol over there. They have something called habu sake. And it's a sake that has a snake coiled up in it. The habu snake is coiled up in the sake, and they drain this venom from the snake into the sake bottle. And when you drink it, it gives you hallucinogenic effects like absinthe or something else. So I found my new best friend. And the way I started drinking that is I saw a sailor come up to the gate staggering up with no pants. His pants were down and stuff, and I'm standing at the gate, and I says, wait a minute. I says, place your ID card on the deck, take 2 steps back. They gave me a gun. They gave me a 9mm. And I'm standing post, and he says, oh, man, how much it costs to get into this club? I said, wait a minute, you're coming on to the United States Embassy grounds. Like, this isn't a club. You're coming on to the embassy. I says, do you know where you are? And he says, yeah, man, I'm 21. Like, let me in. And I'm thinking, sickly, I'm thinking, man, what's he on? I want to try that stuff. And I'm like, place your hand behind your back, and I'm giving him the ride, and I'm secretly asking, what the fuck are you drinking, man? What is that stuff? And he told me, so we tried it. But my alcohol really took a whole new level when I hit the Marines, because there is something about military drinking. And those of you that have been in the service and stuff can probably relate that it is it's strictly on ego. That's all it is. I'm going to drink more than you, and I'm going to make it back, and I'm going to survive the runs and everything else. At least that's what it was for me. So it got so bad in Japan that I would take and we go out, hit the subway in Tokyo, we'd come back, and we'd have to do like a 13-mile run on every other Tuesday. And our competition was to see who could get the most messed up and come back and still do the run. So we had our corpsman. We were genius, right? We had our corpsman come up and pop us with IVs, make us sober, and it worked. And so now we could drink as much as we wanted. We could call the corpsman up for one or two bags, depending on what, how bad we were, and we'd be off and running, and everything was fine. 2 years of that. And I came back, and I hit the States, and that continued on, and now I went back to the infantry, where Marines are Marines, we're the war fighters. And so coming back to the infantry, man, it turned into drinking and fighting each other every night in the barracks. We would just do it for training. We were going to fight. We were, hand-to-hand combat, drink up, and nobody had a problem with it. There was no feelings hurt. There was no sensitive stuff. This was life for us. And so we continue to do this. We end up on deployment and going to some countries, and I'm going to skip all that. But I saw what alcohol would do to my friends, but, we'd find them passed out on deployment in different places, and it never happened to me. I could maintain. I could keep going. I was a sergeant in the Marine Corps by that time. I was a bad dude. That's what I thought. And so I go home on leave, brand new car I bought. I flip my dad the keys. I'm like, check it out, man. And I went out on a little date. And I come back and my car's gone. And my dad's gone, so I know he's at the bar. He comes back and the car is dented up in the front, hit something in the parking lot. And I'm a broke kid, man. It's the first time I could afford something in my life. How am I going to deal with it? Oh, me and Dad are going to fight again. So I remember he comes walking back up. Before I get 2 words out of my mouth, he flips the keys up in the air. I go to grab him, and he, boom, wham, into the wall I go. And I said, shit. Shook it off, and all I see is my dad bolt upstairs, and I see his flash off the balcony. And he's like, I'm like, what the hell is that, my dad? I'm still kind of gathering my sight. And my cousin throws me against the wall. He says, Stevie, don't do it. And he knew that I was going to go after him. Like, I was done. I grew up with that. I was done taking that from him. So I go chasing him out in the backyard, and I can't find him. He's hidden. Well, I find out years later that he was hidden out there with a rifle, with a round in it, loaded, pointing at me, he's just hell-bent on, like, protecting himself. He thinks that he knew I was going to come after him, I guess. But that night caused me to to go with the girl I was on a date with, go to her house, and propose to her that very night. We knew each other 2 weeks. So I proposed to her. I go back down to Camp Pendleton. I come back up a couple weekends, and 2 months later, I'm married to her. And, you know, I'm thinking, hey, I'm going to be loved. Somebody's going to love me, damn it. I'm not going to grow up like this the whole rest of my life and not be loved. I'm shipping off to a combat arena. I want to be loved before I go. Well, it worked for a little while. I went on deployment, so the marriage definitely worked for 8 months. She didn't leave me during that time. But I came home, and she says, I want you out of the Marines. And I thought, yeah, I don't know about that. That's not for me. And I want to stay in the Marines. And so I had to make a choice between marriage and the military. And like I said, that's the only place I ever fit in my entire life. You know, it was the only thing I was ever good at. And so I made a choice to get out and be in this marriage that lasted probably 2 months before we were separated after I got out. And then we decided to make this last-ditch attempt. And guess where we go? Back to Montana, relocation, right? We're going to relocate. Everything's going to be fine. Well, within those first 2 months of me getting out, I had a shotgun in my mouth in a closet. She had to call the cops. I was not doing well. I didn't like civilian life. I remember there were protests in the Bosnian War at the time, and I said, I pray to God that I never get stopped at that stoplight because I'm going to lose it if somebody comes up to my car and starts protesting. And sure as hell it happened. And I said, that's it. Going to Montana, they fly flags. They love America there. And I get up there, and my mom's up there. She's remarried again for her third time. And she's married to this doctor, and I think things are going to be a lot better. Well, the marriage is going to fail. Obviously, it's failing. September 11th happens. I'm on the phone. I got my son is born at that time. He's just coming up on a year old, and there I'm ready to go back in. You know, no doubt about it. And they're giving me everything I want, giving me my rank back, giving me my choice of duty station. And here comes my son waddling up, and he's looking at me, you know, and I said, shit. All right, I'm going to stay out. I'm going to be a dad. So I made that decision. In the midst of all this, I find out that my mom's husband is molesting my brother and sister. And they don't know about it. He's using ether and stuff. They don't know about it, but I know about it now. They kept it from me for several years. So when that happens, I start disappearing up to the wilderness of Montana. I'm looking for a place to gut this guy and leave him for the grizzly bears. You know, that was exactly what I was doing. And I remember seeing this anger management sign, you know, one day. This is one of my first divine interventions, I would say. And I see this sign, and I think, man, there's no way in hell I'll ever go to something like that. That's for a bunch of sissies, you know. And one day when I'm making my final trip out there, I see this sign, and I'm ready to go kidnap him and take him out there. This is all set up. It's in place. And I see this sign, and I remember I turned around the car, and I go, and I knew where the place was, so I had went back, and I walk in the door, and there's a bunch of people in orange. They wear orange jumpsuits in Montana in the jail out there, and there's these guys in orange. And I walk in. I still had my K-bar knife, you know, at my side, and the class was taught by these sheriffs, these two female sheriffs. And I walk in, and I says, I need help, you know. And they said, what the hell, you know, put the knife down, this and that. And that was my first chance. I'm going to try asking for help. Well, I remember there was a Marine that was incarcerated. He was there, and he says, you know, is that a K-bar? Come sit next to me. And I tried this anger management group, and it seemed to have a little impact on me. And I felt pretty good. But then I came home one day, and our son, I chose to stay out of the Marines for our son, and I came home to a note on a table that said, Steve, I went shopping. And that was about 5:30, and at 9 o'clock that night, I get a phone call that they're not coming home. She took him, jumped on a plane, and flew back to California. You know, I thought that was my rock bottom at that point. I thought that there was no recovering from that one. I sat down against the wall. I called a couple Marine buddies, and one guy drove up from Arizona straight through. And I wondered how the hell he got there straight through like that. But, you know, with him, he brought crystal meth Oh, no wonder he got there straight through, right? So his plan to console me is to take me out to the bars, get me messed up, and let's go forget about this. Best way to get over somebody is to get under somebody new. And that was our theory. And so there he takes me out there, and we didn't have a good night. I came back, and I ended up punching him a few times, and he left. And I couldn't understand why. You know, what the hell? What a sissy. He wasn't that big of a sissy in the Marines. So here I am dealing with all my stuff with alcohol and anger. And so I decided in my infinite wisdom again to quit my three jobs. I was working at the post office. I was a reserve police officer, and I was coaching the high school football team. So I quit these jobs with this divorce pending and all this and that. And I should say, because it's true, that there's no way in hell that anybody in their right mind would have stayed with me at that time in my life. So I can't really blame her for how she left and why she left. You know, I have to accept full responsibility for that. I'm sure I was not an easy person to be with. I know that now because of the steps and because of working through the program. I let that bother me for many, many years and hold a grudge and a resentment, a serious resentment over that one. So I quit these jobs. I start bouncing at a strip club. Now I get to fight, drink, and get paid for it. And of course, there's dancing girls upstairs, so it's all good. Well, within a couple weeks of being there, I end up dating a little 19-year-old dancer. And a couple months later, she's pregnant. And when that happened, my ex-wife said, oh, you're not following me to California, and you got a stripper pregnant? You're never going to see your kid again. So here I am in Montana. I got the stuff going on with my mom still. I finally called the cops, let them deal with it. I decided not to kill this guy after all because I have children. And I remember thinking that, okay, well, I'm going to stay in this. We're going to make this relationship work. Right. Yeah, right. So I stay in there. I continue my drinking, my using. And her dad went to AA, and this is the first time I was introduced to AA, and I didn't really remember this until maybe a year ago. But this guy, Steve, he takes me and he says, I'm going to be your sponsor. I'm going to take you into an AA meeting. I said, what the hell is that? I don't know anything about that. We walk into this room, sat down, I listened to this stuff. I lasted about a minute and a half of my attention, and it went out the window. And I sat there like, I am never, ever going to be a part of something like this. Are you kidding me? There's no way in hell. What is this spiritual everything? Nah, no way. And so that didn't last very long. And they said, you know, if you're going to, I could stop the drinking, I thought, but I wasn't going to stop smoking weed. There's no way. And, you know, that was my PTSD medication, medical marijuana. So after a while, I'm faced with a decision to move back to California to fight for custody of my son, which means I'm going to leave my youngest son in Montana and have to drive away and see how both of them in my life, or I'm going to stay in Montana and only have one of my sons in my life. And I chose to go back to California. And when I did that, I moved in with a military buddy, and, you know, he, the same thing, let's just party, party, party. And it kept going and kept going. And finally, I got a job. I got a great job. I became a journeyman lineman. I became an apprentice lineman for a large utility company. And, man, instantly making, you know, $28 an hour. And as I made journeyman, I made 50-something bucks an hour. And making 150 plus a year, you know, now I got a house, a hot tub, a pool table, a truck. I got all this stuff. And I can afford attorneys to fight for custody of my kids, and I got this and that. And life is going on, and they're all a bunch of beer drinkers, so perfect. There's nobody in AA and, you know, at that job. So we drank and we worked hard and we drank and we worked hard, and it continued on. And then my youngest boy, he calls me and says, Dad, I want to come live with you in California. And that's, you know, that was a dream come true for me. It was a chance to have both of my sons in the same environment, be a dad. That's all I ever really wanted. And he came to live with me, and I thought I could do this. But the first thing I also thought was, I need to find a woman to be a mom and help me out in this stuff. So that's what I did. And I was married again within a couple months. We ran to Reno, got it, you know, got married. But at that time, I had hurt my back on the job, but I was still working through it, and they introduced me to painkillers. And, man, I'll tell you what, that stuff grabbed a hold of me and never let go. And it was prescribed, it was all supposed to be, you know, legit. And I started to have my life slowly start to just deteriorate. Well, it deteriorated so much that my son moved back to Montana. His mom knew better. I end up divorced again, annulment, so I don't have to admit it, right? But here I do, it's honesty. And I end up pretty much alone. And through my job, I ended up getting high enough up into the company where I'm working for the executives, and they found that my integrity was going to be at odds with what their plans were. There was some stuff that happened, and the government came in to do an investigation, and I chose to tell the truth because I thought that I had all this honor and integrity. And I did, and I walked on my six-figure job, and I went on unemployment. And when I did that, you know, I could sleep at night in the sense that I had integrity, but the fact was that I had lost everything. You know, that the truck was first, the house was second, the kids, everything, and next thing you know, I'm homeless. And I have nowhere to go, and I wonder what the hell just happened. I'm flying on the corporate jet one minute, and next thing you know, I'm down. But I'm so oblivious to it because I'm so loaded all the time. I'm so drunk. I love to snort whiskey. You know, I loved it. I loved the feeling. It hurt so bad. It was a ritual we did, and it would just kick in right now, and I love that feeling. So I'm at the bars, and I'm, of course, fighting, and I would snort whiskey and start shit, and I end up coming down to Santa Maria because I have nowhere else to go. And while I'm down here, I go to talk to my mom, and she takes one look at me, and she says, "Oh, hell no. You know, what do you, you know, you look like the devil." I said, maybe that's a compliment, you know, I'm feeling all right. So I get on this motorcycle, and by the way, I didn't have a motorcycle license. I borrowed a motorcycle, and I decide that I'm going to head back up north. What the hell do they know? And I go through Cayucas, and there was a little bar there, and it was raining, and they're like, "You're on that motorcycle?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "But I got a wetsuit." So I get drunk and I put on this wetsuit, and I'm leaving the bar, and they're like, "Man, I really hope you don't drive. You don't ride your bike." And I said, "Yeah, whatever, you know, here I go." I said, I figured in my mind that if the cops came after me, I'd take that bike, I'd ride it down on the beach. It was an enduro, and I'd jump in the ocean and come get me, you know. Good luck. So it didn't work out that way. I got to King City, and that first exit in King City, there's three power poles back. That's where the motorcycle broke down. And there I was with no money. I had 10 bucks or something in my pocket, and that's got to go for gas. But there is nobody that's going to drive from Santa Rosa to help me. You know, I was on my own. And so I slept it off in my wetsuit. I ended up stripping the wetsuit off because I had a sleeping bag. I was like Easy Rider in my mind, you know. The world is mine. She's cool. And I sleep it off, and then the next morning some guy saw me from the night before, but he didn't dare stop in the middle of the night. It's Halloween night, and there's this guy in a wetsuit trying to flag down cars. Nobody was stopping for me. But he did come back the next day, and he says, "You know, was that you last night?" I says, "Yeah." He says, "Obviously." And he says, "All right, well, let me jump the motorcycle." He did. I gave him some pot for his troubles, and as soon as he started to leave, the bike died. And I'm like, shit. So now I have to push it up to there. I think there's a Shell station up there, and I push it up there. And right as I crest this little hill, there's two cops. I'm like, oh, man. All right, Steve. Military mode. Suck it up. Boom. And I go up there, man. I don't know how I sobered up like that. I was looked like trash. But I walked up there like it was nobody's business. Cops didn't think nothing of it. I'm saying hi to them. And I think I'm getting away with stuff, right? I think that everything's working out. I get up to whatever that town is, just outside of Salinas, south of Salinas, and bike goes down again, out of gas again. Huh?
Greenfield?
What?
Greenfield?
Yeah, a little north of that. The next, yeah, north of that one, right before Salinas, and Chapala or something like that. And the bike breaks down again. And but I got family there, so they keep bailing me out. I get all this help, and I continue to get this help. And I then I devise a genius plan to go to New York. And I'm going to take my lineman gear because Hurricane Sandy was going on. I could put the power back on. And I decided to take my pistol, right? Because it's my one of my best friends in the Marines does security out there. So here's my plan. I fly out of Oakland and get cleared. I used to inspect weapons for the government at the airport. So I knew the law. I get to New York and they said, "Oh, we're not giving no weapons permits. We're in a state of emergency. Take your gun home." Roger that. I get a flight back 40 hours later. And in JFK, at 6 in the morning, on the Marine Corps birthday, November 10th, I'm getting arrested in New York for having a loaded firearm. Now, my gun wasn't loaded, but in New York, their law says that it was. If you have ammo, a magazine, they can all be put together. And I'm getting arrested for the first time in my life, and I thought, what the hell is this, you know? I'm pissed off, and they threw me in the clink for a few days out there. And then I got bailed out, and I got to come back to California. Homeless in California. Didn't get to go make all that money that I thought I was going to do. I come back here with nothing, nowhere to go, and I was lost completely, and I'm facing felony charges, you know. I thought, oh, man, how am I going to deal with this? Alcohol and drugs. That's how I'm going to deal with it. And I pushed through. I ran out of getting enough money for drugs. So I had to rely on alcohol, and alcohol was a pretty viable solution at the time. But if you're detoxing, if you ever detoxed any kind of drugs, you know that it doesn't feel good. Well, I come out here, I end up, my ex-girlfriend had come down to visit me, and I end up snapping one night. The stress got me, and I snapped and ended up with a domestic violence charge, and I end up arrested. I remember when the cops came, this is my burning bush for me. The cops came, I was crawling around my backyard. I am going to keep you till 8:15, by the way. I was low crawling around my backyard, and I was setting up a perimeter to fireball the cops. I had a bottle of acetone and a lighter, and I was going to fight them off. I was no longer wanting to live, and I wasn't going to do it myself, so I was going to let them do it for me. And needless to say, they came in full force, and there I am in Old Orchid, and I'm looking out my garage door, and my plan would have worked and everything, and I got, all of a sudden something came over me, you know, which I now know is my higher power. And I put down my weapons, and I'm pushed out of this door, and my hands are up, and I'm going, oh, man, like, I don't know what's going to happen to me. I know now all of a sudden I don't want to die, you know. I was not hell-bent on dying. I was afraid. And I knew that this was the only way that I was going to get out of this insanity that I had in my head. It was to be arrested and taken to jail where I knew I was going to have to detox all this stuff. I knew that it wasn't going to be fun. I knew I'm facing charges in New York. Now I'm facing charges here. Life is over. And the sheriffs that came through the gate, I spoke at my graduation from Veterans Court that my angels had badges. You know, they really did. They were kind and gentle to me, man. They put those cuffs on me, and I laid there, and I felt that warmth of the sun. And he said, "It's going to be all right. You're going to be all right." You know, sheriffs tell me that, and I thought, that's not what I want to hear, but it is what I wanted to hear. And I went with it, and they put me in the cop car, and as they're walking me to the cop car, I remember telling my sister, my whole family was there. My sister says, you know, "Don't worry, you'll be out pretty soon." And I says, "You know what, sis, tell them don't ever let me out. I have lost my place in society. I have no business being on the outside. You know, my mind is gone. All I want to do is hurt people, and just tell them to leave me locked up." And I was fully ready to accept that I was going to go to prison. I was going to be there for the rest of my life. I went to a detox, well, I call it my detox cell. I went to an isolation cell, and I was screaming Marine Corps cadences, "Yo, left, right," in this holding cell, and all this shit. So they stick me away And at that time, I think I was meditating. I thought I was the Dalai Lama. I thought I was God. The devil came out. Everything. I went through anything and everything in there. And about 48 days later, I have a chance to get out. They take me in front of Judge Flores, who's a no-nonsense judge, man. He is a no-nonsense kind of guy. And there's a veterans court here in Santa Maria, of all places. And they're not everywhere, but it's a chance for veterans to go and get into a program, get plugged in with the VA, get my issues addressed that I needed. And I get plugged into this veterans court, and I decided, you know, this is my chance. I'm going to run with it. And I ran with it. And the first time I went to the VA and talked to a counselor, she said, "Steve, I've worked with the Marines for 26 years, and that's all it took." And I bawled my eyes out, man, because I thought that I was so much different than every other branch of service and this and that. All my ego was so high, and I thought there's nobody ever going to be able to understand what it's like to be me, you know, what it was like to have my military experience. And I melted, and I started to go to these meetings, and they let me go to detox. Now, when I got to detox, I said, I'm not going to detox for 90 days. There is no way in hell you're not going to make me go to detox. But they were smart, and they take me in there, and the first lady I see was Fran. And she knew my mother and father from growing up here, and she says, "Just sit down. Let's just talk." You know, I'm telling her my story. She says, "Okay, 9 days till your next court appearance." Perfect. All right, I'll sign up for 9 days. That can't be that bad. Well, I signed the paper, and after they did that, they put the little zero there, and I was there for 90 days, you know. They were smart, and so, you know, I remember, Marine stands for muscles are required, intelligence not essential. So, you know, here I am, and they dragged me down here to this meeting at AA, and I sat in this room, and I think I share that story about the acetone and the lighter and the cops, and people are looking at me like, "What the hell is wrong with you?" And as we were walking back that first day, a lady named Renee that used to sit right here, she drove up and she got out of her car at the stop sign up on Cook, and she got out and she says, "Can I give you a hug?" I said, "What?" She said, "Can I give you a hug?" And I said, "Okay." And she gave me this hug. And man, did I just melt again. You know, it was a lot of like, okay, these are genuine people here. You know, I used to think nobody was genuine. I can only trust my Marine brothers, that's it. And there was this genuineness to this place. And so that hug got me to pay a little bit more attention. And there was a speaker meeting that somebody spoke. I had never known this person, never heard him speak. And I was intently listening. And it really was like, wow, you know, I didn't have anything in common with this story, but there, other than the fact that I'm an alcoholic, and that was enough. And I was, you know, as you know, in detox, we did both fellowships, and I picked a sponsor in the other fellowship first and didn't call. Well, I did call, but he never answered the phone, and I thought, well, then I'm not important enough. Screw you. See you later. He's a good man. You know, it wasn't him. It was me. And I got another sponsor, and I wish he was here tonight, but he had come along, and I, too, made that step of getting in a relationship in recovery. And he said, "Well, I don't know how I feel about that." And he went and talked to my girlfriend, and he told her something, and that pissed me off that he did it behind my back. And I said, "There's no way in hell I'm doing a step forward with you. I don't trust you." And I fired him. And I said, "I don't know whether to punch you in the face or give you a hug for caring about me, but I can't go forward with you." So I get introduced to my sponsor who I have now, and it came in the form of a guy telling me, "You need to call this guy. You know, he's a former Marine, he's got 19 years of sobriety, and call him." So I make this leap of faith, you know. Are you willing to do anything and everything? Well, I was. And I made this phone call that forever changed my life. I met him the first time, and I took in that book right there, which I read out of quite often. It's a Cherokee Feast of Days. It's a daily meditational, kind of like what we have here at AA. And there, it's real spiritual. And he was okay with it because I didn't have to define my higher power as being God, you know, or Jesus, it just had to be a higher power. And to me, I really associate with this power greater than myself. And so I started to actually work the steps, you know. And I don't think I ever did step one. I think step one did me. You know, my life, it became very apparent that my life was unmanageable and that there was no way in hell that I was going to figure it out. And it had to be beaten into me. And that's okay today. I'm grateful for everything that led up to where it is, because I could not stop on my own. There was no way in hell. And I was insane. I went into detox, still insane. And I remember, you know, the lotion bottles? You know, everybody knows what hand lotion is, right? The little cap. Well, it was off the top of the lotion. It was laying there, and I thought it was a Bluetooth. You know, I thought they were listening to me, man. I thought, shit, this is crazy. And so the insanity part, right? The insanity was there. And coming here over and over started to restore my sanity. I started to think normal, and that took a long time. I mean, it was 12 months before I could even really, truly feel like I had sanity again. So in my infinite wisdom, I'm still that genius, I decided to skip step 12. I'm going to go right to helping other people, because that's my message. I got it. Forget the rest. I'm going to step 12. I'm going to help everybody. And my sponsor said, all right, go ahead. Tell me how that's going to work out for you. So I did. And I remember I got sponsees after a couple months, and most of them failed. And I remember going to get this one guy. He was a former Marine, too. And he says, come get me, man. I'm getting ready to go into the bar. I said, well, don't drink. I'll be right there. I rolled out of bed. I was sick. I go up there, and he was already tuned up. And I said, all right, get in the car. You know, I got my sobriety. I got a couple months. Get in the car. I ain't getting in the car. I said, get your ass in the car. He ain't getting in the car. So he's with somebody else, and now I'm taking it out on this other guy, too, right? Well, F the both of you. You know, you shut your mouth, you get in the car. I'm the director. And then I get punched. My sponsor knocked the shit out of me. Boom! Damn! You know? And thank God my girlfriend was there. Because she gets in between me, she says, no, you're about to graduate in a couple months. Like, don't do it. Or a couple weeks, don't do it. And for the first time in my life, I didn't fight back. You know? So, instrumental moment, whether it was way ahead of its time or not, it was something that became very important to me, that I don't have to fight back. I can let go of that anger too, because alcohol is not my only problem. You know, anger and violence is also my problem. And so that was a big step for me. And I remember after that, I'm graduating this veterans court, and I decided, okay, I'm going to start working these steps for real. I'm going to make this inventory. And I went on this camp out that's coming up, people. It's coming up on May 15th, there's a men's stag camp out that I went up, and I was able to do my fourth step with my sponsor up there. And I thought for sure that he was going to judge me. He was going to look at me like, you're flat out crazy. Because there's a lot of things I haven't told you guys, you know, but believe it or not. But I said this stuff to him, and he just looked at me and, you know, reached his hand out to me and shook my hand, and the process started, this new process of healing. And I asked for forgiveness for my sins and my character defects. And I started on the journey of my ninth step. And, you know, I knew that was going to be something that was not going to be easy, that ninth step, because I don't want to forgive anybody for anything, you know. I had these resentments. They were excuses for me to stay with this wall, you know, this wall. This wall being the one that, like, when I started, when Ryan and I left this morning to come out here, or this morning, left this evening to come out here, I snap into, I'm going to get back into military mode. We're on a mission. We're going to go speak. We're on a mission. And I get all hard and shit, right? But the truth is that when I'm sitting here listening to Ryan, I got tears in my eyes, because I'm looking at what it's done for him, you know, and having a friend like him to go through this with is amazing, and we live together, and you know, so it shifted from this wall, this guy that would rather just snort alcohol and beat the shit out of you than look at you and shake your hand and care about you. And I certainly did not want to be loved. And I certainly didn't want to stand up here and have people listen to my story like it's anything courageous or anything. You know, it's of no value. It's just my story. But that's not true. You know, if it wasn't for the people that are in these rooms, and I believe I've earned my seat now, man, it would have ended a long time ago. It would have never started back in 1935 and be here today. It works. There's something about it that works. And for me, it was that conscious contact with God. And that's who I choose to call God today after my many, many minutes of hours of analyzing. And what I realized is that I could sit there and debate the fact of what higher power means and this and that, but all I'm doing is artificially putting a roadblock in my way. You know? There's nothing wrong with me accepting a higher power. And so I took that roadblock out of my way to save my life. And that was a huge step. So I stand here today, you know, I'm very humbled that you guys are all still here. You know, I appreciate it. I kept you here past, and I feel really, truly blessed that I was able to share the story with you and be standing here. And I'm grateful for the people that went to the detox panels along the way and gave back. And I'm grateful for all the love that you still show me today, you know, and coming in here. And if you're like me at all and you feel that you're better than or you don't fit in or there's other issues, man, there is help. There really is help. I had to take my, not just my sobriety, but I had to take my mental status to a doctor. And the big book says that. It says, you know, if you have other issues, go get them addressed. You know, this is not the cure-all. But if I didn't have this, I would have never been able to take that other step. Everything started for me right here in this room. And I'm grateful that you asked me to share part of my story. And thank you for listening. As I stand here today, I'm a dad again. You know, life is unfolding inevitably as it should. And so I may not have all the money, you know, I don't care. I donate all my time for the most part to other people. I have a prized car that I love very much. And when Ryan got his license back after 2 years, the first thing I did is flip him that car keys, you know. I trust you with it, man. It's just a car. You know, everything that used to matter doesn't matter anymore. And everything that didn't matter matters now. Yeah. So thank you very much. I'll see you.